wanting to take any chances, I suggested we send someone to McKinney with the warrant, and it was decided that Sartucci and Nielsen would leave at 11 the next morning. Manson, Atkins, and Watson were now in custody, but two other suspects were still at large. From one of the ranch hands at Spawn, LAPD heard that Linda's last name was Kasabian, and that she was supposedly in a convent in New Mexico. This was probably garbled, convent having been mistaken for commune. Marnie Reeves was rumored to be on a farm outside Mobile, Alabama. That same day, Patchett interviewed Terry Melcher regarding his contacts with Manson. He confirmed what Jacobson had already said. He had gone to Spawn Ranch twice to hear Manson and the girls perform and was not enthused. He had also seen Manson twice before this while visiting Dennis Wilson. Melcher, however, added one important detail Jacobson hadn't mentioned. On one of the latter occasions late at night, Wilson had given him a ride back to his house on Cielo Drive. Manson had come along, sitting in the back seat of the car, singing and playing his guitar. They'd driven up to the gate and let him out, Melcher said. Wilson and Manson then driving off. We now knew that Charles Manson had been to 10,050 Cielo Drive on at least one occasion prior to the murders, although there was no evidence that he had ever been inside the gate. At 5:30 that Sunday afternoon, while still at LAPD, I talked to Richard Caballero. A former deputy DA now in private practice, Caballero was representing Susan Atkins on the Hinman charge. Earlier, Caballero had contacted Aaron Stovitz, wanting to know what the DA's office had on his client. Aaron laid it out for him. While at Sybil Brand, Susan Atkins had confessed to two other inmates that she was involved not only in the Hinman, but also the Tate and LaBianca murders. Aaron gave Caballero copies of the taped statements Ronnie Howard and Virginia Graham had given LAPD. Under the law of discovery, the prosecution must make available to a defense attorney any and all evidence against his client. This is a one-way street. While the defense therefore knows in advance exactly what evidence the prosecution has, the defense isn't required to tell the prosecution anything. Although discovery usually occurs after a formal request to the court, Aaron wanted to impress Caballero with the strength of our case, hoping his client would decide to cooperate. Caballero came to Parker Center to see me and the detectives, wanting to know what kind of deal we could offer. In accordance with the earlier discussion between our office and LAPD, we said that if Susan would cooperate with us, we would probably let her plead guilty to second-degree murder, i.e. we would not seek the death sentence, but we would ask for life imprisonment. Caballero went to Sybil Brand and talked to his client. He would later testify, "I told her what the problems were, what the evidence was against her as it was related to me. That included the Hinman case, to which she had already confessed to LASO, and the Tate-LaBianca case. As a result of all this, I indicated to her that there is no question in my mind but they were going to seek the death penalty, and that they would probably get it. I told her, they have enough evidence to convict you. You will be convicted." About 9:30, Caballero returned to LAPD. Susan was undecided. She might be willing to testify before the grand jury, but he was sure she would never testify against the others at the trial. She was still under Manson's domination. Any minute she could bolt back to him. He said he'd let me know what she finally decided. It was left hanging there. Though we had the Howard Graham statements implicating Atkins and physical evidence linking Watson to the Tate murder scene, our whole case against Manson and the others rested on the decision of Sadie Mae Glutz. December 1st, 1969. 7 a.m. Aaron reached me at home. Sheriff Montgomery had just called. If he didn't have a warrant in 2 hours, he was going to release Watson. I rushed down to the office and made out a complaint. McGann and I took it to Judge Antonio Chavez, who signed the warrant, LAPD teletyping it to Sheriff Montgomery with just minutes to spare. I also made out two other complaints, one against Linda Kasabian, the other against Patricia Krenwinkel. The latter, LAPD had learned from LASO, was the real name of Marnie Reeves, a.k.a. Katie. Following the Spahn raid, her father, Joseph Krenwinkel, an Inglewood, California insurance agent, had arranged for her release. On learning this, Sergeant Nielsen had called Krenwinkel, asking where he could reach his daughter. He had told him she was staying with relatives in Mobile, Alabama, and had given him the address. LAPD had then contacted Mobile Police Chief James Robinson, and he had men out looking for her now. Judge Chavez signed these warrants also. Buck Compton, the Chief Deputy District Attorney, called to inform me that Chief Davis had scheduled a press conference for 2 that afternoon. Aaron and I were to be in his office at 1:30. "Buck, this is way too premature," I told him. "We don't even have enough on Manson for an indictment, much less a conviction. As for Krenwinkel and Kasabian, if the story breaks before they're picked up, we may never catch them. Can't we persuade Davis to hold off?" Buck promised to try. At least part of my worry was unnecessary. Patricia Krenwinkel was arrested in Mobile a few minutes before we arrived in Compton's office. Mobile police had gone to the home of her aunt, Mrs. Garnett Reeves, but Patricia wasn't there. However, Sergeant William McKellar and his partner were driving down the road that runs in front of the residence when they saw a sports car with a boy and a girl inside. As the two cars passed, McKellar noticed the female passenger pulled her hat down lower over her face. Convinced this was an effort to avoid identification, the officers pulled a quick U and sirened the car to a halt. Though the girl fitted the teletype description, she said her name was Montgomery, the same alias Watson had used. On being taken to the aunt's home, however, she admitted her true identity. The young man, a local acquaintance, was questioned and released. Patricia Krenwinkel was read her rights and placed under arrest at 3:20 p.m. Mobile time. 1:30 p.m. Buck, Aaron, and I met with Chief Davis. I told Davis that I had scraped together barely enough evidence against Krenwinkel and Kasabian to get warrants, but it was all inadmissible hearsay. Leslie Sangston's statement to McGann, Susan Atkins' statements to Virginia Graham and Ronnie Howard. "We can't get a grand jury indictment on this," I told him, adding, "If Susan Atkins doesn't cooperate, we've had it." "There were over 200 reporters and cameramen waiting in the police auditorium," Davis said, "representing not only all the networks and wire services, but newspapers from all over the world. There was no way he could call it off now." Shortly before the press conference, Lieutenant Helder called both Roman Polanski and Colonel Paul Tate, telling them the news. For Colonel Tate, the news meant the end of his months-long private investigation. Despite his diligence, he had not come up with anything that was of use to us. But at least now, the wondering and suspicion were over. 2 p.m. Facing 15 microphones and dozens of bright lights, Chief Edward M. Davis announced that after 8,750 hours of police work, LAPD had solved the Tate case. Warrants had been issued for the arrests of 3 persons: Charles D. Watson, 24, who was now in custody in McKinney, Texas; Patricia Krenwinkel, 21, who was in custody in Mobile, Alabama; and Linda Kasabian, age and present whereabouts unknown. It was anticipated that an additional 4 or 5 persons would be named in indictments, which would be sought from the Los Angeles County Grand Jury. Neither Charles Manson nor Susan Atkins was mentioned by name in the press conference. "These persons," Davis continued, "were also involved in the murder deaths of Rosemary and Lino LaBianca." This came as a big surprise to most of the newsmen, since LAPD had maintained almost from the start that there was no connection between the two homicides. Though a few reporters had suspected the crimes were linked, they had been unable to sell their theories to LAPD. Davis went on to say, "The Los Angeles Police Department wishes to express their appreciation for the magnificent cooperation rendered by other law enforcement agencies during the development of information regarding both of the above cases, in particular, the Los Angeles Sheriff's Office." Davis did not mention that it had taken LAPD over 2 months to follow up the lead LASO had supplied them the day after the Tate murders. Questioned by reporters, Davis credited tenacious investigation carried on by robbery-homicide detectives with forcing the break in the case. He stated that the investigators developed a suspicion which caused them to do a vigorous amount of work in this Spahn Ranch area and the people connected with Spahn Ranch, which led us to where we are today. There was also no mention of that 10-cent telephone call. The reporters ran for the phones. Caballero called Aaron. He wanted to interview Susan Atkins on tape, but he didn't want to do it at Sybil Brand, where there was a chance one of the other Manson girls would hear of it. Also, he felt Susan would be inclined to talk more freely in other surroundings. He suggested having her brought to his own office. Though unusual, the request wasn't unprecedented. Aaron made up a removal order, which was signed by Judge William Keene, and that evening Susan Atkins, escorted by 2 sheriff's deputies, was taken to Caballero's office, where Caballero and his associate, Paul Caruso, interviewed her on tape. The tape was for 2 purposes, Caballero told Aaron. He wanted it for the psychiatrists in case he decided on an insanity plea. And if we went ahead on the deal, he would let us listen to it before we took the case to the grand jury. December 2nd, 1969. LAPD called a few minutes after I arrived at the office. All 5 suspects were now in custody, Linda Kasabian just having voluntarily surrendered to Concord, New Hampshire police. According to her mother, Linda had admitted to being present at the Tate residence, but claimed she had not participated in the murders. It looked as if she wasn't going to fight extradition. A somewhat different decision had been reached in Texas. McKinney was less than 30 miles north of Dallas and only a few miles from Farmersville, where Charles Watson had grown up and gone to school. Audie Murphy had been a Farmersville boy. Now they had another local celebrity. The news had already broken by the time Sartucci and Nielsen reached McKinney. Stories in the Texas papers described Watson as having been an A student in high school, a football, basketball, and track star who still held the state record for the low hurdles. Most local residents expressed shocked disbelief. Charles was the boy next door, one said. It was drugs that did it, an uncle told reporters. He started taking them at college, and that was where the trouble started. The principal of Farmersville High was quoted as saying, "It almost makes you afraid to send your kids off to college anymore." On the instruction of Watson's attorney, Bill Boyd, the Los Angeles detectives were not allowed to speak to his client. Sheriff Montgomery wouldn't even permit them to fingerprint him. Sartucci and Nielsen did see Watson, however, accidentally. While they were talking to the sheriff, Watson passed them on the stairs on his way to the visitor's room. According to their report, he was well-dressed, clean-shaven, with short, not long hair. He appeared in good health and looked like a clean-cut college boy. While in McKinney, the detectives established that Watson had gone to California in 1967 and that he hadn't moved back until November 1969, long after the murders. Sartucci and Nielsen returned to Los Angeles convinced we'd have little cooperation from the local authorities. It wasn't only a matter of relatives. Somehow the whole affair had become involved in state politics. Little cooperation would be a gross exaggeration. Reporters were busy tracing the wanderings of the nomadic family and interviewing those members not in custody. I asked Gail to save the papers, knowing the interviews might be useful at a later date. Though still uncharged with the murders, Charles Manson had now taken center stage. Sandy, the first time I heard him sing, it was like an angel. Squeaky, he gave off a lot of magic, but he was sort of a changeling. He seemed to change every time I saw him. He seemed ageless. There were also interviews with acquaintances and relatives of the suspects. Joseph Krenwinkel recalled how in September 1967, his daughter Patricia left her Manhattan Beach apartment, her job, and her car, not even picking up a paycheck due her to join Manson. I am convinced he was some kind of hypnotist. Krenwinkel was not the only one to make that suggestion. Attorney Caballero talked to reporters outside the Santa Monica courtroom where his client had just entered a not guilty plea to the Hinman murder. Susan Atkins was under the hypnotic spell of Manson, Caballero said, and had nothing to do with the murders, despite her presence at the Hinman and Tate residences. Caballero also told the press his client was going to go before the grand jury and tell the complete story. This was the first confirmation we had that Susan Atkins had agreed to cooperate. That same day, LAPD interviewed Barbara Hoyt, whose parents had persuaded her to contact the police. Barbara had lived with the family off and on since April 1969 and had been with them at Spahn, Myers, and Barker ranches. The pretty 17-year-old story came out in bits and pieces over several interviews. Among her disclosures, one evening while at Spahn, about a week after the August 16th raid, she had heard screams that seemed to come from down the creek. They lasted a long time, 5 to 10 minutes, and she was sure they were Shorty's. After that night, she never saw Shorty again. The next day, she heard Manson tell Danny DiCarlo that Shorty had committed suicide, with a little help from us. Manson had also asked DiCarlo if Lime would dispose of a body. While at Myers Ranch, in early September 1969, Barbara had overheard Manson tell someone, she wasn't sure who, that it had been real hard killing Shorty once he had been brought to now. They'd hit him over the head with a pipe, Manson said, then everyone stabbed him, and finally Clem had chopped his head off. After that, they'd cut him up in 9 pieces. While still at Myers, Barbara had also overheard Sadie tell Uish about the murders of Abigail Folger and Sharon Tate. Sometime later, Uish told Barbara that she knew of 10 other people the group had murdered. Not long after this, Barbara and another girl, Sherry Ann Cooper, a.k.a. Simi Valley Sherry, fled the family's Death Valley hideout. Manson caught up with them in Ballarat, but because other people were present, he let them go, even giving them $20 for their bus fare to Los Angeles. We later received information indicating that Manson may have sent 3 of his followers to Los Angeles with instructions to either bring back the girls or kill them, but we were never able to prove this. This was the same trip when a flat tire prevented the murder of Kathy Gillies' grandmother, the owner of Myers Ranch. Although very frightened, Barbara agreed to cooperate with us. That cooperation would nearly cost her life. About this same time, another of Manson's girls agreed to help the police. She was the last person from whom I expected cooperation, Mary Brunner, the first member of the Manson family. Following his release from prison in March 1967, Charles Manson had gone to San Francisco. A prison acquaintance found him a room across the bay in Berkeley. In no hurry to find a job, subsisting mostly by panhandling, Manson would wander Telegraph Avenue or sit on the steps of the Sather Gate entrance to the University of California, playing his guitar. Then one day along came this librarian. As Charlie related the story to Danny DiCarlo, she was out walking her dog. High-button blouse, nose stuck up in the air, walking her little poodle. And Charlie's fresh out of the joint, and along he comes talking his bullshit. Mary Brunner, then 23, had a B.A. degree in history from the University of Wisconsin and was working as an assistant librarian at the University of California. She was singularly unattractive, and Manson apparently was one of the first persons who thought her worth cultivating. It was possible he recalled the days when he lived off Fat Flo. So one thing led to another, DiCarlo resumed. He moved in with her. Then he comes across this other girl. No, there will be no other girls moving in with me, Mary says. She flatly refused to consider the idea. After the girl had moved in, 2 more came along. And Mary says, I'll accept 1 other girl, but never 3. 4, 5, all the way up to 18. This was in Frisco. Mary was the first. The family had been born. By this time, Manson had discovered the hate. According to a tale Manson himself often told his followers, one day a young boy handed him a flower. "It blew my mind," he'd recall. Questioning the youth, he learned that in San Francisco there was free food, music, dope, and love, just for the taking. The boy took him to Haight-Ashbury, Manson later told Steve Alexander, a writer for the underground paper Tuesday's Child. "And we slept in the park, and we lived on the streets, and my hair got a little longer, and I started playing music, and people liked my music, and people smiled at me and put their arms around me and hugged me. I didn't know how to act. It just took me away. It grabbed me up, man, that there were people that are real." They were also young, naive, eager to believe, and perhaps even more important, belong. There were followers aplenty for any self-styled guru. It didn't take Manson long to sense this. In the underground milieu into which he'd stumbled, even the fact that he was an ex-convict conferred a certain status. Wrapping a line of metaphysical con that borrowed as much from pimping as joint jargon and Scientology, Manson began attracting followers, almost all girls at first, then a few young boys. "There are a lot of Charlies running around, believe me," observed Roger Smith, Manson's parole officer during his San Francisco period. "But with one big difference. Somewhere along the line, I wasn't yet sure how or where or when, Manson developed a control over his followers so all-encompassing that he could ask them to violate the ultimate taboo. Say kill, and they would do it." Many automatically assumed the answer was drugs. But Dr. David Smith, who got to know the group through his work in the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, felt sex, not drugs, was the common denominator in the Manson family. A new girl in Charlie's family would bring with her a certain middle-class morality. The first thing Charlie did was to see that all this was worn down. That way he was able to eliminate the controls that normally govern our lives. Sex, drugs, they were certainly part of the answer, and I'd soon learn a great deal more about how Manson used both, but they were only part. There was something more, a lot more. Manson himself de-emphasized the importance of drugs, at least as far as he was concerned. During this period, he took his first LSD trip. He later said that it enlightened my awareness, but added being in jail for so long had already left my awareness pretty well open. Aware, Charlie was. Manson claimed he foresaw the decline of the hate even before it came into full flower. Saw police harassment, bad trips, heavy vibes, people ripping off one another and ODing in the streets. During the famous Summer of Love, with free rock concerts and Owsley's Acid and 100 more young people arriving every day, he got an old school bus, loaded up his followers, and split, looking for a place to get away from the man. Mary Brunner eventually left her job and joined Manson's wandering caravan. She had a child by him, Michael Manson, the whole family participating in the delivery, Manson himself biting through the umbilical cord. Interviewed in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, where she had gone following her release from jail, Mary Brunner agreed to cooperate with the police in return for immunity in the Hinman murder. She supplied numerous details regarding that crime. She also said that in the latter part of September 1969, Tex Watson had told her about the murder of Shorty. They had buried his body near the railroad tracks at Spawn, Tex said, and Gypsy abandoned his car in Canoga Park near a residence the family had previously occupied on Gresham Street. On the basis of this information, LASO began a search for both the body and the vehicle. Obviously, Mary Brunner would be an important witness in both the Hinman and Shea cases. Though she had been in jail when the Tate and LaBianca murders occurred, for a time I even considered using her as a witness in that case, since she could testify to the beginnings of the family. But I remained very leery of her. According to others I interviewed, her devotion to Manson was fanatical. I just couldn't visualize her testifying against the father of her child. The Tate case had been big news abroad since the murders occurred, eclipsing even the incident at Chappaquiddick. The arrests commanded just as much attention. Because of the time difference, it was nearly midnight of December 1st before reports of the hippie kill cult reached London. As in the United States, the sensational dispatches dominated the headlines of the papers the next day, led off radio and TV broadcasts. At 11 that morning, a maid in the Telgarth Hotel on Telgarth Road in London tried to open the door of a room occupied by an American youth named Joel Pugh. It was locked from the inside. Shortly after 6 p.m., the hotel manager unlocked the door with a passkey. It only opened about 1 foot, he stated. There seemed to be a weight behind it. Kneeling down and reaching in, I felt what seemed like an arm. He hastily called the police. A constable from Hammersmith Station arrived minutes later and pushed the door open. Behind it was the body of Joel Pugh. He was lying on his back, unclothed except for a sheet over the lower half of his body. His throat had been slit twice. There was a bruise on his forehead, slash marks on both wrists, and 2 bloody razor blades, 1 less than 2 feet from the body. There were no notes, although there were some writings in reverse on a mirror, along with some comic book-type drawings. According to the manager, Pugh had checked into the room on October 27th with a young lady who had left after 3 weeks. A hippie in appearance, Pugh was quiet, went out rarely, seemed to have no friends. There being no wound not incapable of being self-inflicted, the coroner's inquest concluded that Pugh took his own life while the balance of his mind was disturbed. Although the circumstances of the death, including the wounds themselves, were equally, if not more, consistent with murder, it was considered a routine suicide. No one thought the drawings or writings important enough to take down. The manager later recalled only the words Jack and Jill. No attempt was made to determine the time of death. Nor, though Pugh's room was on the ground floor and could be entered and left through the window, did anyone feel it necessary to check for latent prints. At the time, no one connected the death with the big American news that day. If it hadn't been for a brief reference in a letter over a month later, we probably would have remained unaware that Joel Dean Pugh, age 29, former Manson family member and husband of family member Sandra Good, had joined the lengthening list of mysterious deaths connected with the case. When she and Squeaky moved out of their motel room in Independence, Sandy left some papers behind. Among them was a letter from an unidentified former family member which contained the line, "I would not want what happened to Joel to happen to me." December 3rd, 1969. About 8 that night, Richard Caballero brought the Susan Atkins tape to LAPD. He requested that no copy be made. However, I was allowed to take notes. In addition to myself, both Lieutenants Helder and LePage and 4 or 5 detectives were present while the tape was being played. We said little as, with all the casualness of a child reciting what she did that day in school, Susan Atkins matter-of-factly described the slaughter of 7 people. The voice was that of a young girl, but except for occasional giggles, and Sharon went through quite a few changes, laughs, quite a few changes. It was flat, emotionless, dead. It was as if all the human feelings had been erased. What kind of creature is this, I wondered. I'd soon know. Caballero had agreed that before we took the case to the grand jury, I could personally interview Susan Atkins. The tape lasted about 2 hours. Although the monumental job of proving their guilt remained, when the tape had ended, Caballero saying to Susan, "Okay, now we're going to get you something to eat, including some ice cream," we at least knew, for the first time, exactly who had been involved in the Tate and LaBianca murders. Though Manson had sent the killers to 10,050 Cielo Drive, he had not gone along himself. Those who did go were Charles Tex Watson, Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Linda Kasabian. One man, three girls, who would mercilessly shoot and stab five people to death. Manson, however, did enter the Waverly Drive residence the next night to tie up Rosemary and Lino LaBianca. He then sent in Watson, Krenwinkle, and Leslie Van Houten, a.k.a. Sangston, with instructions to kill them. Susan Atkins herself hadn't been inside the LaBianca residence. She had remained in the car with Clem and Linda, but she had heard from Manson, Krenwinkle, and Van Houten what had occurred inside. Though the tape cleared up some mysteries, many remained, and there were discrepancies. For example, although Susan admitted stabbing the big man, Frykowski, five or six times, in self-defense, she said nothing about stabbing Sharon Tate. In contrast to what she had told Virginia Graham and Ronnie Howard, Susan now claimed that she had held Sharon while Tex stabbed her. Returning to my office, I did what I do after every interview, converted my notes into a tentative interrogation. I had a lot of questions I wanted to ask, Sadie Mae Glutz. Linda Kasabian waived extradition proceedings and was flown back to Los Angeles that same day. She was booked into Sybil Brand at 11:15 p.m. Aaron was there, as was Linda's attorney, Gary Fleischman. Though Fleischman permitted her to ID some photographs of various family members which Aaron had, he would not let Aaron question her. Aaron did ask her how she felt, and she replied, tired, but relieved. Aaron got the impression that Linda herself was anxious to tell what she knew, but that Fleischman was holding out for a deal. December 4th, 1969. Confidential Memorandum. To Yvel J. Younger, District Attorney. From Aaron H. Stovitz, Head, Trials Division. Subject, Susan Atkins. A meeting was held today in Mr. Younger's office, commencing at 10:20 a.m. and concluding at 11 a.m. Present at the meeting were Mr. Younger, Paul Caruso, Richard Caballero, Aaron Stovitz, and Vincent Bugliosi. Discussion was had as to whether or not immunity should be given to Susan Atkins in exchange for her testimony at the grand jury hearing and subsequent trial. It was decided that she would not be given immunity. Mr. Caballero made it known that at this moment his client may not testify at the trial due to her fear of the physical presence of Charles Manson and the other participants in the Sharon Tate murders. Discussion was held concerning the value of Susan Atkins' testimony. Agreement was reached upon the following points. 1. That Susan Atkins' information has been vital to law enforcement. 2. In view of her past cooperation and in the event that she testifies truthfully at the grand jury, the prosecution will not seek the death penalty against her in any of the three cases that are now known to the police, namely the Hinman murder, the Sharon Tate murders, and the LaBianca murders. 3. The extent to which the district attorney's office will assist defense counsel in an attempt to seek less than a first-degree murder, life sentence, will depend upon the extent to which Susan Atkins continues to cooperate. 4. That in the event that Susan Atkins does not testify at the trial, or that the prosecution does not use her as a witness at the trial, the prosecution will not use her testimony given at the grand jury against her. Caballero had made an excellent deal as far as his client was concerned. If she testified truthfully before the grand jury, we could not seek the death penalty against her in the Hinman, Tate, and LaBianca cases, nor could we use her grand jury testimony against her or any of her co-defendants when they were brought to trial. As Caballero later put it, she gave up nothing and got everything in return. For our part, I felt we got very much the short end. Susan Atkins would tell her story at the grand jury. We'd get an indictment. And that would be all we would have, a scrap of paper. For Caballero was convinced she would never testify at the trial. He was worried that even now she might suddenly change her mind. We had no choice but to rush the case to the grand jury, which was meeting the following day. our case was getting a little stronger. The previous day, Sergeant Sam McLarty of the Mobile Police Department had taken Patricia Krenwinkel's prints. On receiving the exemplar from Mobile, Sergeant Frank Martz of LAPD made one print. The print of the little finger on Krenwinkel's left hand matched a latent print Officer Bowen had lifted from the frame on the left French door inside Sharon Tate's bedroom. This was the blood-splattered door that led outside to the pool. We now had a second piece of physical evidence linking still another of the suspects to the crime scene. But we didn't have either suspect. Like Watson, Krenwinkel intended to fight extradition. She would be held 14 days without bond. If extradition papers were not there before the 15th day, she would be released. Caballero drove me to his office in Beverly Hills. By the time we arrived, about 5:30 p.m., Susan Atkins was already there, having been taken out of Sybil Brand on the basis of another court order requested by Aaron. Caballero had suggested that Susan would be much more apt to speak freely with me in the relaxed atmosphere of his office than at Sybil Brand, and Miller Levy, Aaron, and I had agreed. Although she had opened up to both Virginia Graham and Ronnie Howard, my interview with Susan Atkins on the Tate-LaBianca murders was the first she had had with any law enforcement officer. It would also be the last. 21 years old, 5'5", 120 pounds, long brown hair, brown eyes, a not unattractive face, but with a distant, far-off look, similar to the expressions of Sandy and Squeaky, but even more pronounced. Although this was the first time I had seen Susan Atkins, I already knew quite a bit about her. Born in San Gabriel, California, she had grown up in San Jose. Her mother had died of cancer while Susan was still in her teens, and after numerous quarrels with her father, she dropped out of high school and drifted to San Francisco. Hustler, topless dancer, kept woman, gun moll. She'd been all these things even before meeting Charles Manson. I had a certain amount of pity for her. I tried my best to understand her. But I couldn't summon up very much compassion, not after having seen the photographs of what had been done to the Tate victims. After Caballero introduced us, I informed her of her constitutional rights and obtained permission to interview her. A male and female deputy sheriff sat just outside the open door of Caballero's office, watching Susan's every move. Caballero remained for most of the interview, leaving only to take a few phone calls. I had Susan tell me the whole story, from the time she first met Manson in Haight-Ashbury in 1967 to the present. Periodically, I'd halt her narrative to ask questions. Were you, Tex, or any of the others under the influence of LSD or any other drug on the night of the Tate murders? No. What about the next night, the night the LaBiancas were killed? No, neither night. There was something mysterious about her. She would talk rapidly for a few minutes, then pause, head slightly cocked to the side, as if sensing voices no one else could. You know, she confided, Charlie is looking at us right now, and he can hear everything we are saying. Charlie is up in Independence, Sadie. She smiled, secure in the knowledge that she was right, and I, an outsider, an unbeliever, was wrong. Looking at her, I thought to myself, this is the star witness for the prosecution. I'm going to build my case upon the testimony of this very, very strange girl. She was crazy. I had no doubt about it. Probably not legally insane, but crazy nonetheless. As on the tape, she admitted stabbing Frykowski, but denied stabbing Sharon Tate. I'd conducted hundreds of interviews. You get a sort of visceral reaction when someone is lying. I felt that she had stabbed Sharon, but didn't want to admit it to me. I had to interview over a dozen witnesses that same night. Winifred Chapman, the first police officers to arrive at Cielo and Waverly, Granado and the fingerprint men, Lomax from High Standard, Coroner Noguchi and Deputy Medical Examiner Katsuyama, DiCarlo, Melcher, Jacobson. Each presented special problems. Winifred Chapman was petulant, querulous. She wouldn't testify to seeing any bodies or any blood, or... Coroner Noguchi was a rambler. He had to be carefully prepared so he would stick to the subject. Danny DiCarlo hadn't been believable in the Beausoleil trial. I had to make sure the grand jury believed him. It was necessary not only to extract from very disparate witnesses, many of them experts in their individual fields, exactly what was relevant, but to bring these pieces together into a solid, convincing case. 7 murder victims, multiple defendants. A case like this was not only probably unprecedented, it required weeks of preparation. Because of Chief Davis's rush to break the news, we'd had only days. It was 2 a.m. before I finished. I still had to convert my notes to interrogation. It was 3:30 before I finished. I was up at 6 a.m. In 3 hours, we had to take the Tate and LaBianca cases before the Los Angeles County Grand Jury. December 5th, 1969. Sorry, no comment. Although grand jury proceedings are by law secret, neither the DA's office, the witnesses, nor the jurors being allowed to discuss the evidence, this didn't keep the reporters from trying. There must have been 100 newsmen in the narrow hallway outside the grand jury chambers. Some were atop tables, so it looked as if they were stacked to the ceiling. In Los Angeles, the grand jury consists of 23 persons, picked by lot from a list of names submitted by each superior court judge. Of that number, 21 were present, 2/3 of whom would have to concur to return an indictment. The proceedings themselves are usually brief. The prosecution presents just enough of its case to get an indictment and no more. Though in this instance the testimony would extend over 2 days, the star witness for the prosecution would tell her story in less than one. Attorney Richard Caballero was the first witness, testifying that he had informed his client of her rights. Caballero then left the chambers. Not only are witnesses not allowed to have their attorneys present, each witness testifies outside the hearing of the other witnesses. The Sergeant-at-Arms, Susan Atkins. The jurors, 7 men and 14 women, looked at her with obvious curiosity. Aaron informed Susan of her rights, among which was her right not to incriminate herself. She waived them. I then took over the questioning, establishing that she knew Charles Manson and taking her back to the day they first met. It was over 2 years ago. She was living in a house on Lyon Street in the Haight-Ashbury district of San Francisco, with a number of other young people, most of whom were into drugs. Answer. And I was sitting in the living room, and a man walked in, and he had a guitar with him, and all of a sudden he was surrounded by a group of girls. The man sat down and began to play, and the song that caught my attention most was The Shadow of Your Smile, and he sounded like an angel. Question. You are referring to Charles Manson? Answer. Yes. And when he was through singing, I wanted to get some attention from him, and I asked him if I could play his guitar. And he handed me the guitar, and I thought, I can't play this. And then he looked at me and said, You can play that if you want to. Now, he had never heard me say, I can't play this. I only thought it. So when he told me I could play it, it blew my mind, because he was inside my head, and I knew at that time that he was something that I had been looking for, and I went down and kissed his feet. A day or two later, Manson returned to the house and asked her to go for a walk, and we walked a couple blocks to another house, and he told me he wanted to make love with me. Well, I acknowledged the fact that I wanted to make love with him, and he told me to take off my clothes, so I uninhibitedly took off my clothes, and there happened to be a full-length mirror in the room, and he told me to go over and look at myself in the mirror. I didn't want to do it, so he took me by my hand and stood me in front of the mirror, and I turned away, and he said, Go ahead and look at yourself. There is nothing wrong with you. You were perfect. You always have been perfect. Question. What happened next? Answer. He asked me if I had ever made love with my father. I looked at him and kind of giggled, and I said no. And he said, "Have you ever thought about making love with your father?" I said, "Yes." And he told me, "All right. When you were making love, picture in your mind that I am your father." And I did. I did so. And it was a very beautiful experience. Susan said that before she met Manson, she felt she was lacking something. But then I gave myself to him, and in return for that, he gave me back to myself. He gave me the faith in myself to be able to know that I am a woman. A week or so later, she, Manson, Mary Brunner, Ella Jo Bailey, Lynette Frome, and Patricia Krenwinkel, together with three or four boys whose names she couldn't remember, left San Francisco in an old school bus from which they had removed most of the seats, furnishing it with brightly colored rugs and pillows. For the next year and a half they roamed, north to Mendocino, Oregon, Washington, south to Big Sur, Los Angeles, Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, and eventually back to L.A., living first in various residences in Topanga Canyon, Malibu, Venice, and then finally Spawn Ranch. En route others joined them, a few staying permanently, most only temporarily. According to Susan, they went through changes and learned to love. The girls made love with each of the boys and with each other. But Charlie was complete love. Although he did not have sex with her often, only 6 times in the more than 2 years they were together, he would give himself completely. Question: were you very much in love with him, Susan? Answer: I was in love with the reflection, and the reflection I speak of is Charlie Manson's. Question: was there any limit to what you would do for him? Answer: no. I was laying the foundation for the very heart of my case against Manson, that Susan and the others would do anything for him, up to and including murder at his command. Question: what was it about Charlie that caused you girls to be in love with him and to do what he wanted you to do? Answer: Charlie is the only man I have ever met on the face of this earth that is a complete man. He will not take back talk from a woman. He will not let a woman talk him into doing anything. He is a man. Charlie had given her the name Sadie Mae Glutz because in order for me to be completely free in my mind, I had to be able to completely forget the past. The easiest way to do this, to change identity, is by doing so with a name. According to Susan, Charlie himself went under a variety of names, calling himself the Devil, Satan, Soul. Question: did Mr. Manson ever call himself Jesus? Answer: he personally never called himself Jesus. Question: did you ever call him Jesus? From my questioning the night before, I anticipated that Susan would be evasive about this, and she was. Answer: he represented a Jesus Christ-like person to me. Question: do you think Charlie is an evil person? Answer: in your standards of evil, looking at him through your eyes, I would say yes. Looking at him through my eyes, he is as good as he is evil. He is as evil as he is good. You could not judge the man. Although Susan didn't state that she believed Manson was Christ, the implication was there. Though I was at this time far from understanding it myself, it was important that I give the jury some explanation, however partial, for Manson's control over his followers. Incredible as all this was to the predominantly upper-middle-class, upper-middle-aged grand jurors, it was nothing compared to what they would hear when she described those 2 nights of murder. I worked up to them gradually, having her describe Spawn Ranch and the life there, asking her how they survived. People gave them things, Susan said. Also, they panhandled. And the supermarkets all over Los Angeles throw away perfectly good food every day, fresh vegetables and sometimes cartons of eggs, packages of cheese that are stamped to a certain date, but the food is still good, and us girls used to go out and do garbage runs. DiCarlo had told me of one such garbage run when, to the astonishment of supermarket employees, the girls had driven up in Dennis Wilson's Rolls-Royce. They also stole credit cards, other things. Question. Did Charlie ask you to steal? Answer. No, I took it upon myself. We'd get programmed to do things. Question. Programmed by Charlie? Answer. By Charlie. But it's hard for me to explain it so that you can see it the way I see. The words that would come from Charlie's mouth would not come from inside him. They would come from what I call the infinite. And sometimes at night, they creepy crawled. Question. Explain to these members of the jury what you mean by that. Answer. Moving in silence so that nobody sees us or hears us. Wearing very dark clothing. Question. Entering residences at night. Answer. Yes. They would pick a house at random, anywhere in Los Angeles, slip in while the occupants were asleep, creep and crawl around the rooms silently, maybe move things so when the people awakened they wouldn't be in the same places they had been when they went to bed. Everyone carried a knife. Susan said she did it because everybody else in the family was doing it, and she wanted that experience. These creepy crawling expeditions were, I felt sure the jury would surmise, dress rehearsals for murder. Question. Did you call your group by any name, Susan? Answer. Among ourselves, we called ourselves the family. It was, Susan said, a family like no other family. I thought I heard a juror mutter, "Thank God." Question. Susan, were you living at Spawn Ranch on the date of August the 8th, 1969? Answer. Yes. Question. Susan. On that date, did Charlie Manson instruct you and some other members of the family to do anything? Answer. I never recall getting any actual instructions from Charlie other than getting a change of clothing and a knife and was told to do exactly what Tex told me to do. Question. Did Charlie indicate to you the type of clothing you should take? Answer. He told me, wear dark clothes. Susan ID'd photos of Watson, Krenwinkle, and Kasabian, as well as a photo of the old Ford in which the four of them left the ranch. Charlie waved to them as they drove off. Susan didn't notice the time, but it was night. There was a pair of wire cutters in the back seat, also a rope. She, Katie, and Linda each had a knife, Tex had a gun, and, she believed, a knife too. Not until they were en route did Tex tell them, to quote Susan, that they were going to a house up on the hill that used to belong to Terry Melcher, and the only reason why we were going to that house was because Tex knew the outline of the house. Question. Did Tex tell you why you four were going to Terry Melcher's former residence? Matter-of-factly, with no emotion whatsoever, Susan replied, to get all of their money and to kill whoever was there. Question. It didn't make any difference who was there. You were told to kill them. Is that correct? Answer. Yes. They got lost on the way. However, Tex finally recognized the turnoff and they drove to the top of the hill. Tex got out, climbed the telephone pole, and using the wire cutters, severed the wires. LAPD still hadn't got back to me regarding the test cuts made by the pair found at Barker. When Tex returned to the car, they drove back down the hill, parked at the bottom, then, bringing along their extra clothing, walked back up. They didn't enter the grounds through the gate because we thought there might be an alarm system or electricity. To the right of the gate was a steep, brushy incline. The fence wasn't as high here. Susan threw over her clothing bundle, then went over herself, her knife in her teeth. The others followed. They were stowing their clothing in the bushes when Susan saw the headlights of a car. It was coming up the driveway in the direction of the gate. Tex told us girls to lie down and be still and not make a sound. He went out of sight. I heard him say, "Halt." Susan also heard another voice, male, say, "Please don't hurt me. I won't say anything." and I heard a gunshot, and I heard another gunshot, and another one, and another one. 4 shots. Then Tex returned and told them to come on. When they got to the car, Tex reached inside and turned off the lights. Then they pushed the car away from the gate, back up the driveway. I showed Susan a photo of the Rambler. It looked similar to it, yes. I then showed her the police photograph of Stephen Parent inside the vehicle. Answer: that is the thing I saw in the car. There were audible gasps from the jurors. Question: when you say thing, you are referring to a human being? Answer: yes, human being. The jurors had looked at the heart of Susan Atkins and seen ice. They went on down the driveway, past the garage to the house. Using a scale diagram I'd had prepared, Susan indicated their approach to the dining room window. Tex opened the window, crawled inside, and the next thing I knew, he was at the front door. Question: did all of you girls enter at that time? Answer: only 2 of us entered. 1 stayed outside. Question: who stayed outside? Answer: Linda Kasabian. Susan and Katie joined Tex. There was a man lying on the couch. Susan ID'd a photo of Wojtek Frykowski. The man stretched his arms and woke up. I guess he thought some of his friends were coming from somewhere. He said, "What time is it?" Tex jumped in front of him and held a gun in his face and said, "Be quiet. Don't move or you're dead." Frykowski said something like, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" Question: what did Tex say to that, if anything? Answer: he said, "I am the devil, and I'm here to do the devil's business." Tex then told Susan to check for other people. In the first bedroom, she saw a woman reading a book. Susan ID'd a photo of Abigail Folger. She looked at me and smiled, and I looked at her and smiled. She went on. A man and a woman were in the next bedroom. The man, who was sitting on the edge of the bed, had his back to Susan. The woman, who was pregnant, was lying on the bed. Susan ID'd photos of Jay Sebring and Sharon Tate. The pair were talking, and neither saw her. Returning to the living room, she reported to Tex that there were 3 more people. Tex gave her the rope and told her to tie up the man on the couch. After she'd done this, Tex ordered her to get the others. Susan walked into Abigail Folger's bedroom, put a knife in front of her, and said, "Get up and go into the living room. Don't ask any questions, just do what I say." Katie, also armed with a knife, took charge of Folger while Susan got the other 2. None offered any resistance. All had the same expression on their faces: shock. On entering the living room, Sebring asked Tex, "What are you doing here?" Tex told him to shut up, then ordered the 3 to lie on their stomachs on the floor in front of the fireplace. "Can't you see she's pregnant?" Sebring said. "Let her sit down." When Sebring didn't follow Tex's orders, Tex shot him. Question: did you see Tex shoot Jay Sebring? Answer: yes. Question: with the gun that he had taken from Spawn Ranch? Answer: yes. Question: what happened next? Answer: Jay Sebring fell over in front of the fireplace, and Sharon and Abigail screamed. Tex ordered them to be quiet. When he asked if they had any money, Abigail said she had some in her purse in the bedroom. Susan went with her to get it. Abigail handed her $72 and asked if she wanted her credit cards. Susan said she didn't. On their return to the living room, Tex told Susan to get a towel and retie Frykowski's hands. She did, she said, but couldn't get the knot very tight. Tex then took the rope and tied it first around Sebring's neck, then the necks of Abigail and Sharon. He threw the end of the rope over the beam in the ceiling and pulled on it, which made Sharon and Abigail stand up so they wouldn't be choked to death. Then, I forget who said it, but one of the victims said, "What are you going to do with us?" And Tex said, "You were all going to die." And at that time they began to plead for their lives. Question. What is the next thing that happened? Answer. Then Tex ordered me to go over and kill Frykowski. As she raised her knife, Frykowski, who had managed to free his hands, jumped up and knocked me down, and I grabbed him as best I could, and then it was a fight for my life, as well as him fighting for his life. Somehow he got a hold of